I wish I felt better about this.
I know, Lorraine said. I know. I'm almost afraid of what's going to happen in the next few days. If the demon was angry enough to follow them here...
She didn't have to finish the sentence. The Demon Retaliates. For the next 2 weeks, life at the Smurl duplex in West Pittston became nearly intolerable. Just as the Warrens feared, the haunting increased in ferocity. Mary,
the day Janet and Jack appeared on the TV show was one of the worst days ever on our side of the house. The banging got so loud at one point that we actually had to leave the house. Finally, the noise quieted down enough that we could go back inside with the girls, but then the banging started up on Janet and Jack's side. It was loud enough that it kept us up all night.
John.
The same day I started experiencing the psychic colds again. It was like something was drawing the heat from my body. I remember shivering so hard that I was afraid my teeth were going to crack. I was worried about Mary, too. Given her heart condition, the doctor said the worst thing that could happen to her was constant stress. And that's what we were all under. Constant, constant stress.
3 nights later, asleep, Janet Smurl sensed the covers being eased sinuously off her body and cast on the floor. As her eyes started to flutter open and her head began to rush with a disorienting feeling of losing control of her body, she saw that she was now suspended in midair. What was even more startling was that, in a perfectly prone position, she was being floated across the room. As if she were undergoing some lighter-than-gravity experience, she bumped into the bedroom wall, then bounced away. Then the demon quit having fun with her and hurt her viciously. Janet.
Obviously, it's not something I'll ever forget. It twisted me around several times and then hurled me into the far wall. Just before I crashed, I crossed my hands over my skull to protect it from the collision. Then the demon turned me over very quickly and at such an angle that my hands and arms were outstretched. I only had a few seconds to put myself into the fetal position because I could see the demon was going to catapult me again into the wall, this time trying to break my hands and arms. All the time this was happening, I was screaming for Jack to wake up, really pleading with him. But of course the demon had seen to it that Jack was in a deep psychic sleep. What happened finally, I can't even really describe. All I could think of was being in a trance. I saw everything in our shadowy bedroom very clearly, but at the same time I had the sense that I was caught between worlds, this one and the life after, almost as if I was hanging between life and death itself. And then suddenly, I was lying next to Jack, and I was sobbing, really out of control. And he woke up and tried to calm me down, asking me what had happened. And I showed him the bruises from where the demon had slammed me into the wall, and then I went back to sobbing again. I was afraid I'd really been pushed over the edge. You know the feeling? When you just can't handle things anymore? That's how I was. I really couldn't deal with things anymore.
Jack's test on the edge would come the following night. Jack. The kids knew what had happened to their mother, being levitated and all, so they let her rest all day and did all the housework themselves, and even helped with dinner. They could see how precarious her health was getting. I told her to call Ed and Lorraine while I was at work, just to keep her calm. Well, she did, and talking to them helped a lot. When I got home, we had dinner and watched a little TV. Janet was exhausted, drained, so we put the kids to bed early and then sacked out early ourselves. According to the digital clock, I was asleep about a half hour before I heard the thing. The thing Jack referred to was a creature roughly 8 feet in height that stood on two legs but had, on top of its wide shoulders, a furry head with blinding red eyes and a pig-like snout. Standing at the end of the bed, the creature slavered and slobbered, then clawed at the air with rake-like fingers, seeming to threaten Jack with evisceration. Even more repugnant than the shape of the creature's face was the slobbering noises of its lips, which resembled pieces of liver as they took in air and saliva. Janet.
Jack's scream woke me up, and almost instantly, I started screaming too, even though by then the creature he described was gone. I'd never seen Jack that shaken by anything before. He'd thrown himself off the bed and lay in a ball in the middle of the floor. In the moonlight, you could see that his whole body was covered in sweat. His hands were in fists that he kept pounding against the floor. I couldn't tell which emotion was stronger in him, fear or anger. The whole family was going through that. We were tired of being afraid. Yet we didn't want to give in to the demon either. I went over and lay down on the floor next to Jack and slowly began to run my hands softly up and down his back, trying to calm him down. His breathing was still coming in big, gasping chunks. It took me 10 minutes to get him calmed down. Then he said to me,
"Now I know what hell's going to look like."
He tried describing the creature to me again, but he'd run out of words that could do the job. I wasn't all that interested in imagining the thing anyway. I didn't need much convincing that the form the demon had assumed was disgusting. I'd had plenty of my own experience with it. I got Jack in bed and went down the hall and got him a drink of water. When I came back, he had a rosary in his hands. His lips were moving silently in prayer, but it was his eyes I kept staring at. He was still in a kind of shock. Obviously, he couldn't forget what he'd just seen. He stayed awake all night, just like that.
Over the next few weeks, several of the Warren team members visited the Smurls, and they returned with increasingly bizarre accounts of what life at the Smurl house had become. Gloria Domosky, Janet's mother, on a visit to the Smurl home, heard a voice resembling Jack's calling her. Yet when she investigated, she found that it was not Jack at all, but a voice that appeared from nowhere. A few days later, Mary Smurl heard a similar voice calling her. Again, when she checked through the house, she found nothing. The following day, Jack was attacked at 2 a.m. by invisible forces that scalded his legs with some kind of intense heat. Only holy water doused the searing pain. Janet and Jack were kept up all night by the phone ringing on and off. This woke and upset the girls, and the couple spent much of the night trying to convince the girls everything was all right. The next night, banging in the walls began again in series of three knocks, a signal from the demon. The same night around 3 a.m., the phone started in again, three rings in each burst, and so the family, including all the girls, simply got out of bed and went down to the kitchen, where Janet made everybody sandwiches. Janet found humor in the situation.
"What a ridiculous way to have a picnic,"
she told her family, as the wall banging continued. The next night's incident was not so funny. The heat being very intense, West Pittston was setting records. Janet and Jack slept wearing very little, and with all the covers except the sheet pushed on the floor. Down the street a dog barked. A motorcycle carrying a young couple out on a late date zoomed down the street. The shadows of heavy maple leaves played against Jack's sleeping form. Janet watched her husband fondly. During the trial of the last few years, she'd grown to admire and respect him more than ever. Janet.
"It was while I was lying there, getting very sentimental about our relationship, that I sensed the mist gathering. It was a very fine mist, almost like an ocean spray, and I felt it before I saw it. I remember trying to touch my face, and then I realized that I couldn't move my arm. I was in some kind of hypnotic state. Then the man appeared. He had very bright, almost neon eyes that were a mixture of yellow and green, and two animal horns protruded from his head. Strangely, he also had a very bushy mustache. The mist covered his face so that I could not get a careful look at his features, just the eyes burning in the hollows of his face. I had no doubt what he wanted, and I remember wishing I was wearing more clothes. I knew I needed to break through the spell he had cast if I was going to avoid what he wanted from me. Several times I tried calling out, but no words came from my throat, and then I said the Hail Mary. I could hear my voice cracking and sounding like a child's, it was so weak, but at least I could hear it. As I said the first words of the Hail Mary, I could see that the creature's eyes glowed with an even deeper hatred of me. Then suddenly my voice became very loud, I suppose out of desperation, and I saw the creature start to dematerialize. My arms started to function again. I grabbed the bottle of holy water and sprinkled some at the creature, and finally it disappeared entirely.
Jack. It was time for drastic measures, and both of us knew it. We had to look at the upside and the downside, the upside being, of course, that if we went public, revealed our names and identities, somebody might hear our story and contact us with the information we needed to sweep our home clean of the haunting. We hoped that there was somebody else out there who had gone through the same things and might have some wisdom for us. Certainly we couldn't be the only people who'd ever had this sort of supernatural experience. We even felt, as we sat and talked about it, that when the priests at the diocese office heard about it, they would be shamed into helping us. How could they refuse us when our plea was so public? The downside was what we'd feared all along, that once the public heard our story, they would turn against us, see us as lunatics or publicity seekers. Both Janet and I are proud people, especially where our children are concerned, and we did not want to see them subjected to ridicule and suspicion. But the longer we talked about it, the more we realized we had to do it, go public, and see if we could find help, even at the risk of exposing ourselves to ridicule. Ed Warren. The Sunday of that week, the Smurls called us after having a long meeting in a restaurant in which they decided to really go public with their story. Not even hide behind a screen to conceal their faces or identities. Lorraine and I believed that Janet's and Jack's sudden desire to find a public forum offered one very good possibility, that the Scranton Diocese would have to recognize at last that something was going on in West Pittston that they had yet to take seriously. I also agreed with Jack, as we spoke that night on the phone, that there was at least a chance that somebody well-versed in the history of West Pittston would come forward with a vital piece of information. I also raised the possibility of more exorcisms.
More? Jack said. Ed, we've had two.
I explained to him that sometimes several exorcisms were necessary, and that we've been involved with cases where scores of exorcisms had to be performed before diabolical entities were driven from a home. Then I warned him about the public reaction.
I know, Jack sighed. It could be pretty bad.
I chose my next words carefully, not wanting to upset him unduly, but wanting him to understand the gravity of what I was saying.
Public reaction starts to have a life of its own, Jack. Very quickly it can turn into a circus, particularly with the media involved. One day you can be a hero, and the next you can be a scoundrel or a liar. You have to be careful of this, especially when something as volatile as the supernatural is involved.
I paused. I just want you to be aware of this.
Are you saying not to do it?
No. I'm just trying to prepare you. We're friends, Jack.
A silence. Then, we have to do it, Ed. We have to.
For all the arguments I'd given him to the contrary, I knew it was right. After supernatural rape and at least two incidents that could justifiably be called life-threatening and with no apparent end in sight, Janet and Jack had no choice but to take the ultimate risk, the risk of exposing themselves to a fickle and sometimes vicious public.
The Devil Incarnate. Jack, could you tell us what happened the night the beast appeared to you?
It wasn't a happy time.
Meaning?
Meaning, we were beginning to wonder if anything we did would help our circumstances.
Could you explain?
Well, this was a few days after we'd decided to go public with our story.
I see.
And it was a few weeks after our appearance on television.
Had you had any reaction to your appearance on the Richard Bay show?
That was the problem. We'd gotten many sympathetic phone calls, at least none of the kooks called up. But unfortunately, no one was able to help us with our problem. About the best they could do was wish us well.
So this was a depressing time.
Yes, as you know, the haunting activities had been intense. The dark form appeared in Shannon's room in the middle of the night, and we got very worried about her. We couldn't stop her crying. We'd never seen her this grief-stricken. She just couldn't be calmed down, no matter what we said or did.
Did something happen to Dawn, too?
Yes.
She woke up at 5 one morning and went downstairs to get a glass of water. On her way down, she heard 3 loud knocks on the front door. She came upstairs to get me, but when I got down there, nobody was there. We both went back to bed, and then for the next 15 minutes, it really gave Janet and me a show, banging inside the closet, slamming the drawers in the triple dresser, and flipping dresser handles up and down. But then, that had been pretty much standard operating procedure for the past few weeks. Following the TV show, it seemed to have this need to reestablish its dominance. "Would you tell us about the incident with Simon?" I was lying in bed. Janet was asleep, but I was having trouble nodding off, so I just lay there smoking a cigarette in the darkness when I heard Simon beginning to gasp. That's the only way I can describe it. He just couldn't get his breath. This terrible feeling came over me. I love Simon almost as much as I do my own children. I had started to get up from the bed to see what was wrong with him when I felt this presence in bed next to me. Now, I never saw this presence, but I sensed it. There was this huge heartbeat, very regular and very loud, filling the room. And then something gripped my right arm so tight I thought it was going to literally crush it. Then a really fetid odor started to fill my nostrils, and I was afraid I was going to pass out. I jerked my left hand toward the nightstand. I can remember the sound of several things being knocked to the floor, but I didn't care. And somehow, I got the holy water, and I sprinkled it across myself and said the prayer that Ed and Lorraine had taught us. And then finally, it was gone. How about Simon? By the time I reached him, he was all right, thank God. He was scared, and you could tell that. He was curled up in the corner and still kind of whimpering very low, but when I started petting him, he calmed down.
Then you went back to bed?
Yes.
And did anything else happen that night?
Yes, a little later on I went down to the bathroom, and that's when I saw it. Nothing I'd seen before could have prepared me for it.
Can you describe it for us?
I'll try. I wish I was better at this kind of thing. It was huge, for one thing. It had 2 animal legs. I'd say they resembled a horse's legs. And part of its face was human, and part, the snout, I guess, was that of an animal, with black wet nostrils and brown fur over most of its skull and face. It had rounded hips that were covered with fur and eyes that kind of shone. There's no other way to describe it. They shone, but at the same time, they were human, too. It saw me and slashed at the air with hands, or hooves, that looked partly human and looked partly animal. It made a snorting sound that almost made me nauseous to hear. I got all this in a glimpse as soon as I turned the light on, and almost immediately the creature charged at me. The most threatening thing about it was its sheer size. This thing was at least 7 feet tall. All I could think of was that a horse and a human had been grafted together in a real crude way, and then the thing was swiping the air at me.
What did you do?
I ran down the hall.
It came after you?
Most definitely. Even though our hallway is carpeted, it was running so hard after me that you could hear the stomping sounds its hooves made on the rug.
This sounds something like the creature you'd seen a few weeks earlier.
It was, very definitely. But there was something more terrifying about this one.
What did you do?
I got into bed and pressed myself back against the headboard and started to reach for the holy water.
Started to?
The thing was still slashing at the air.
Then what?
Then I grabbed a prayer book from the nightstand and lifted it toward the creature, and then it ran across the bed.
Across the bed?
Yes, it was real. I could smell it and hear it and feel it running across the bed. But then it just vanished into the wall.
You're sure it wasn't a dream?
No, because as I sat there, and I was really shaken, I was nearly in tears, and no matter what I tried, I couldn't wake Janet up. I could smell its odor in the room. So could Janet when she did wake up.
Didn't that make you think twice about going public?
No. In an odd way, it made up our minds that going public was the only thing left to us, because the entity was really going berserk. Mary and John were being bothered again, spending many sleepless nights because of the banging, and then even our neighbors started being hauled into our situation.
Which neighbors were those?
Daniel and Louise Harrington.
Statement of Louise Harrington.
A few months before, strange things began happening to my family. My husband Daniel, who was an insurance representative, my 21-year-old daughter Julie, my 16-year-old son Daryl. Janet Smurl had told me some of the things that had occurred in her home. As a licensed practical nurse, I've seen the ravages of mental illness close up. The absolute belief on the part of a psychotic personality that something took place when, in fact, it didn't. While I certainly didn't think Janet or anyone in her family was psychotic, her revelations were so odd that I frankly didn't know what to make of them. These days, because of movies and television, we all have at least a rudimentary understanding of the occult. But what Janet told me was unlike anything I'd seen on a screen. Most of it wasn't as dramatic. In what she'd told me, there weren't any monsters, per se. But lighting fixtures did drop from the ceiling, and terrible odors filled the house, and there was almost constant banging in the walls. Coming from Janet, who was a very level-headed person, it was all plausible, but still I had to wonder if her imagination hadn't run away with her. In the summer of 1986, I abruptly and convincingly found out otherwise. On hot summer nights, my husband and I often stay up late and watch TV. Even with all the windows open, the house is too hot for any prolonged sleep. You wake up bathed in sweat. This particular summer night was setting heat records, so we sat in front of the television, watching a crime movie and sipping iced tea. It was 2 in the morning, and the movie had just started. The next day was Saturday, so we could sleep late. The movie had been running for perhaps 5 minutes when the screaming started. At first it was so horrible it almost sounded fake, by which I mean there's a way women scream in the movies that rarely resembles the way they scream in real life. This sounded more like a movie scream. The screaming went on for no longer than a minute, then faded.
"My God,"
my husband said.
"What was that?"
"I'm not sure," I said. He got up and went out on the front porch and looked around and came back in.
"Didn't see anything."
My heart pounding. We waited a few more minutes before allowing ourselves to get caught up in the movie again. We'd been watching it another 20 minutes when the screaming came again. This time it was so piercing and ragged and threatening that it literally lifted me off the couch.
"It's coming from the Smurl house," Daniel said.
"But that's impossible," I said. "Janet told me that the whole family was going camping this weekend. We saw them leaving this morning, remember?"
"God, you're right," Daniel said. "But what the—"
Then another burst of screaming exploded on the night air. Because our house is very near the Smurls, the sound of the woman shrieking might as well have been coming from our own living room. Daniel went to the side window and looked up at the Smurl house. As the screaming continued, he said,
"It seems to be coming from Dawn and Kim's room."
And that seemed to be the case. I scanned the Smurl house carefully, listening to the tortured sounds even though they were beginning to really frighten and somehow aggravate me. "But who could be in there?" I asked. He reminded me of what Janet had said about the haunting. All I could think about was ghosts running around in sheets, like children on Halloween, but I knew that what we were dealing with here was real and serious, and maybe even deadly. Neither of us slept well that night. We kept getting up to check on the children. Instinctively, we seemed to understand that the force operating in the Smurl house, and by now we had no doubt that what Janet had been telling us was absolutely real, might somehow threaten our children. As soon as Janet and Jack returned, we went over to their duplex and told them about our experience. They shared with us some advice given them by their friends Ed and Lorraine Warren and told us to pray that the entity would not include us in its plans. A few nights later, Daniel and I discovered that the entity had indeed decided to inflict itself on our lives. Our daughter Julie is a college student. If the word normal can apply to anybody, it most certainly applies to her, spending the bulk of her time in a world of pizza, rock and roll, boys, and fortunately a very serious attitude toward her studies. Around 2 a.m., I was watching TV after work. I work a late shift and am keyed up when I get home. My husband was asleep in the front bedroom, and Daryl was asleep in the middle bedroom. Julie's bedroom is at the end of the house. Julie was awakened by the sound of scratching at the window. The window does not have any trees or bushes around it and is on the second floor. she wondered if somebody might be trying to break in. Of course, I knew none of this until she came downstairs and said, "There's something in my room, Mom, and it's ice cold up there." Then she told me about the scratching. I didn't know what to make of it, so being protective, I asked her to come over and sit with me. Her fear was catching. I was afraid to go into her room as well. She sat with me till 4 or so, and then I walked her back to her room. Neither of us slept well that night. Unfortunately for my daughter, this was not to be her only experience with the supernatural. A week after the scratching incident, she came running downstairs in her yellow nightgown. She looked to be freezing, her arms folded tightly across her chest, her teeth chattering. I wondered if she'd suddenly gotten a fever. "Julie, I drifted off to sleep, and when I started to wake up, I realized that my whole body was covered with goosebumps and was trembling. Sometimes in the winter, you kick the covers off yourself while you're asleep, and you wake up and you're really freezing. It was like that, only worse. My whole body was shaking. I couldn't stop. By the time I got completely awake, it was like I was inside a meat locker. Really. The thing was, this was a very hot summer night. And again, I felt this presence in the room with me. The temptation was just to lie there because I was still drowsy, but I knew that something serious would happen to me if I didn't force myself up out of bed and go find my mother." When I asked Janet Smurl about Julie's experience, she told me it was something that had happened to her daughters many times. I also described to Janet other curious things that had been happening, our front door opening and closing by itself in the middle of the night. At first, I'd thought it might be our other son, Eddie, coming in late, but I went downstairs to have a look, and there it was, opening and closing. It happened twice, with nobody in sight. Of course, Janet knew firsthand that my family was getting drawn into the Smurl haunting. My son Daryl was at the Smurl house one afternoon with Dawn and her cousin Scott Bloom. Dawn and Scott went into the kitchen, leaving Daryl alone in the living room. He sat there several minutes by himself reading a magazine, and then he heard tapping sounds coming from the coffee table. He looked under the table but found nothing. He couldn't see anything that could cause such tapping. Gradually, he came to understand that there was a presence in the room. The tapping continued as Dawn and Scott came back into the room. Daryl described to Dawn what had been happening.
"Don't worry," Dawn said. "You get used to it."
But Daryl felt curiously exhausted, drained. Later on, Janet explained to me how the entity literally draws on the energy of human beings for sustenance. All I knew when Daryl appeared in the doorway telling me of his tapping experience was that my son looked pale and shaken. I put him to bed immediately. He remained exhausted for many hours. And the haunting continued to be part of our lives. Julie, on the phone one day, heard the magnetic latch on her clothes closet creak open and then, after several seconds, shut itself again. Julie felt a being in the room with her. She slammed down the phone and ran from the room, terrified. Daniel. Sometimes in the summer, I like to go for walks when I can't sleep. This one night, I did that, and when I got home, I saw that the Smurl house was completely dark. Then I remembered they were out of town. I started up the steps to my duplex, and that's when I heard it. This giant, fluttering sound moving from window to window inside the Smurl house. You got the impression that some gigantic bird was trapped inside there and was trying desperately to get out. Then tappings started against the windows. Very sharp tappings, almost like gunshots. I don't mind admitting that I didn't stay around for the rest of the show. I ran up the steps and inside my house and closed all the windows and checked the locks on the doors. Only a temporary escape. 2 weeks after the phone conversation in which Jack Smurl had told Ed Warren that he and Janet had decided to go public, the Smurls had yet to take any steps that would make their decision a reality. Jack. Every time we'd go to pick up the phone and call a newspaper or a TV station, one or both of us would say that maybe we'd better think this over a little longer. Looking back, I'd say we were probably trying to stall until some kind of solution presented itself that wouldn't involve revealing ourselves to the media. The prospect of that was still just about as unnerving as the haunting itself. Not that Jack didn't keep in close touch with the Warrens during this time. We talked virtually every day, and what we talked about was an idea I was almost afraid to bring up because it was so radical. But that certainly was my mood at the time. Very radical. I just wanted to be done with the haunting. My idea was simple. I asked Ed and Lorraine if they thought it would be a good idea if we had the house torn down and leveled and then moved away. We would suffer great financial losses, but at least it might be a new start for us, for all of us, Janet and the kids, and my mother and father as well. Now, I knew what Ed would say, that the entity had already proved it could follow us and had in fact followed us to the campground, to the motel in Philadelphia, and even to my office. However, when I looked at everything carefully, I thought I discerned a certain pattern. That even though the entity followed us, when it left the house, it did not seem to commit acts nearly as atrocious as those it committed inside the duplex. So I asked Ed his opinion about us demolishing the house and then moving, and I certainly recall his answer. Ed, the day Jack called and said he was thinking of leveling his home, the home he'd worked all his life to own, I knew that the Smurls were at a very dangerous place. In fact, a part of me wondered if the demon hadn't already defeated the family. The other part of the conversation that bothered me was that Jack was desperately pushing for answers that I could not, in all honesty, provide. Would the spirit follow them? Would the spirit be as malicious in a new place? Would the spirit be with them the rest of their lives? In a few previous cases of infestation, we'd seen this kind of despair before, and it's always heartbreaking to behold, particularly when you see it in as good and reliable a man as Jack Smurl. A grave injustice had been done to him and his family, and he was asking me, pleading with me, really, for help, any kind of help, now in the form of advice. So that day I did all I could. I said that I did not think that tearing down and leveling his house was a good idea. I said that it would be an expensive and painful process, and that there would be no guarantee whatsoever that this would accomplish what he was trying to accomplish. I said that maybe if he thought about it some more, a better plan would evolve, one that would not see him destroy something he and his parents were so proud of. Reluctantly, he agreed with me. I have to say that after we hung up, I felt very bad, and Lorraine and I began saying prayers for the Smurl families immediately. We had seen certain families pushed to the brink and subsequently pushed over that brink. Would that happen to the Smurls? We wondered. Jack had finished his conversation with Ed that afternoon. The rest of the day, gloomy that none of his ideas were working out, Jack spent in the kitchen making notes about the nearly 2 years of severe haunting and seeing if any new plans suggested themselves. Without his realizing it, dusk came purple in the windows. Janet, finished with the dinner dishes, sat down with Jack and asked if he wanted to talk. He looked haggard, and she was worried about him. Janet,
we started talking about a number of options, which included renting a place for a time, but we knew the children's lives would suffer, and we wondered, too, what the impact would be on Mary's life. Then there was the prospect of renting a place with new neighbors and having them find out through some incident that we were a supernaturally besieged family. I mean, it would be pretty embarrassing to move into an apartment house and have the people below us hear cloven hooves running up and down the hallway. We must have sat there for 2 hours. The kids got ready for bed and kissed their father goodnight and went upstairs, and we just kept on sitting there, talking about what we could do. Every time we thought nothing could get any worse, it would get worse. And right now was a good example. Here was Jack with a week of vacation, and instead of enjoying ourselves, we were in the kitchen brooding about the haunting. And somewhere in there, the idea came to us. I'm not even sure which one of us had the idea first, and it doesn't matter. It was just there, and it was something we should have thought of earlier, something that would, in effect, be the same thing as raising our duplex, something that would allow us to see just how bad the infestation had become and what would happen if both Smurl families moved out. By dawn the next morning, we had packed up the van and were setting off for the campground. We were laughing, too. We really felt a sense of optimism.
Flight. The experiment both Smurl families attempted did not work successfully. Mary Smurl was interviewed at length about it. Mary, what was the experiment all about?
We felt, all of us, that if we all left the entire house empty for a week, we'd be able to see how the demon would respond. If it would follow us, and if so, what would it do?
So you felt that if you all went to the campground for a week and nothing happened, then you'd be safe to move and the demon wouldn't follow you?
Yes.
Were you as optimistic as Janet and Jack?
At that point, we were ready to try, and maybe even believe in, just about anything.
So it didn't take much convincing to get you to pack your bags and go along in the van?
No convincing at all.
Your husband John felt the same way?
Yes. What you have to remember is that within the span of a few short years, we'd been forced to move out of our house in Wilkes-Barre because of the flood, and then we'd finally found a place where we could spend our retirement years, and you know what I'm talking about. All John could say over and over the week before we left for the campground was, "Why does it want to make us suffer?" He was worried about my health, and I was starting to worry about his health, too.
His health was suffering?
Well, on TV and in the newspapers, you always see material on the relationship between stress and illness. And I think it's hard for most people to understand the kind of stress we'd been under. And I mean constant stress. When somebody talks about a knocking in the wall in print, it may not look that threatening, but believe me, when you're sitting in your living room and all of a sudden something begins banging inside your wall, your whole system responds. According to the article, stress damages your immune system. You could see that. All of us were getting colds and flu and headaches, and you certainly didn't have to wonder why.
So you were hopeful that a week at the campground would show you a way of escaping?
Yes. Even though we'd put all our money into the duplex, we were willing to lose what we had and start over. We felt that if our faith in God was strong enough, we'd make it. So that's why we went to the campground. We even made a pact.
A pact?
Yes. Janet and Jack and John and I. We said that no matter what happened, no matter where the demon forced us to live, we would continue living together as a family. Janet even said, if we have to leave our house empty and rent a second place to do that, we will. This thing won't beat us. It won't. It was a very emotional point, and John and I both had tears in our eyes.
Can you describe the campground?
Oh, it's the sort you see in the Pennsylvania hills, kind of like a little village, really. When you put all the campers and their cars together. One problem we had right off was the weather. Black rain clouds hung low in the sky, and it was chilly for a summer day.
Were the rain clouds a portent?
You mean like an omen?
Yes.
They could have been.
It didn't go so well at camp?
No. What happened?
Another long pause. It is obvious to the interviewer that Mary is gathering her strength. She has begun to fidget.
The demon attacked my bed in the camper.
Would you describe that for us, please?
The bed is nailed to the floor. There is no way you can move it. That first night, it was just after midnight, I was asleep in the camper when I heard very hard and rapid rappings on the roof and floor. I started to get up out of my bed, but before I could, I felt the whole bed being ripped from the floor, jerked to the left and then jerked to the right. You could hear the nails tearing at the floor.
Did anybody come to help you?
I screamed, of course, but one thing about the demon is its speed. The whole incident was over before anybody could reach me.
It just stopped?
It just stopped.
Mary's fragile health is never more apparent than during this interview. As she speaks, her eyes take on a curiously luminous quality, and whatever anger she might have for the demon is dissipated by sheer physical weariness. What were your feelings then, Mary, about the whole situation? Long pause.
It was becoming obvious that not only could the demon follow us, but it could pretty much do what it wanted to.
How did the week at the campground go from there? She looks at the interviewer and shakes her head. Her words are barely audible.
From there it only got worse. Much worse.
But hadn't things like this happened when Janet and Jack had visited the campground before?
Yes. But what was supposed to be special about this trip was that both families had left the entire house vacant. In a very real sense, we had turned over the house to the demon as a kind of sacrifice. We wanted to see if it would respond by leaving us alone at the campground.
So if it had left you alone, then we'd realize that what it wanted was something in the house itself, and we'd all vacate. We'd do what Janet had said. We'll rent it if we have to, but we'd move right away and we'd stay together no matter what.
So when the demon tried to tear your bed from the floor, what was the reaction?
Well, the first thing was, of course, that everybody was very frightened for me.
What did they feel about the demon in general?
Well, even though we all agreed it was too soon to tell how the week would go for sure, we had a pretty good suspicion, I'm afraid, of what lay ahead for us. It turned out to be a terrible week. And I was sorry we had Scott Bloom along because things got pretty tough for everybody. But then, we'd had high hopes that it would be a real vacation. A troubling realization. The time was 3 a.m., the third day of the camping trip. Jack lay awake, still thinking about the incident that had taken place around midnight, when he'd gotten up in response to a shout from his father from a sleeping berth near the front of the camper.
"I couldn't believe it," John Smurl had anxiously told his son. "I felt the whole mattress being lifted up from under me. I was afraid it was going to throw me into the wall. Then I looked out the window."
John Smurl had shaken his head, exhausted from his encounter with the supernatural.
"I saw this white form appear outside the window. I'd have to say it was dressed in chiffon, and it stayed there a moment and then just walked away. Just like that."
Jack had embraced his father to keep the older man from trembling. A rage rose in Jack, one he knew well by now, one he had no idea what to do about. So now it was 3 a.m., and he lay awake. By now, the fourth day of their camp sojourn just ahead of him, he knew the answer to the question he'd come here to find out. Wherever Jack Smurl went, the entity was going to follow. There in the darkness, moonlight casting long shadows through the camper windows, the scent of wood smoke from the campfire outside pleasant on the air, there in the darkness, the entity responded to Jack Smurl's bitterness. The sound of animal hooves striking the metal roof penetrated the darkness like gunfire. Jack sat upright, bathed in sweat, and wanting to physically attack the unseen force that was tormenting him. He rushed over to the center of the camper, to where the holy water was kept. Armed with a vial of the sacred fluid, he stood up and began sprinkling the water across the ceiling. As he did so, he let his eyes rove out to the campsite, to the guttering fire and the leafy summer oaks encircling them. Sitting on a picnic table bench, looking calm and peaceful like a contented picnicker, was the faceless, cloaked black form that Jack knew to be the demon itself. An anger he'd never known before, a blinding anger that turned him into a being that was as much animal as man, overtook Jack, and he smashed into the camper door so hard he nearly took it off its hinges. Janet came wide awake and jumped up to grab on to her husband. She'd never seen him this furious before. A glance out the window told her why he was so enraged. The black form had followed them. All she could understand at this moment was that she had to stop Jack from confronting the black form. Jack slammed open the door and started down the steps.
"No," Janet cried. "You don't know what it will do to you."
But Jack seemed not to hear her. His eyes were fixed on the transparent black form sitting on the bench, flames from the guttering fire casting an eerie red glow over its demonic body. In Jack's hand, Janet realized for the first time, was a bottle, a weapon.
"No,"
she cried again and reached out for Jack, trying to stop him. But it was no use. Jack shrugged off her hands and walked, stalked, really, toward the demon, which sat in plain sight as if it was waiting for Jack. Janet.
Jack had just left the camper when it disappeared, as it usually did. Just vanished. I can't tell you the relief I felt. I was so proud of my husband for wanting to defend us, but at the same time, I didn't want to see him hurt. I knew that his anger was just giving the demon a perfect excuse to murder him. And that's what I was praying against.
The remaining days of the camping trip went no better. John.
Toward the end of the week, Mary was very run down. Most nights we were up listening to noises on the roof or smelling the odors the thing was pushing into the camper. It took its toll. There's no doubt about that.
Dawn came to her mother one day and said,
Grandma's crying, Mom. You'd better go help her.
Janet found Mary Smurl in the camper, weeping. Janet.
You could see the effects the whole week it had on her. Her health wasn't strong to begin with, and this week had just about shattered her.
The weather wasn't helping either. It was difficult to enjoy a week in the outdoors when a steady drizzle fell much of the time, or when the temperature slipped as low as 50 degrees. There were two nights remaining on their planned outing. Janet asked Jack if he wanted to return to West Pittston.
Want to be like admitting defeat, honey?
Janet sighed, forced to agree with him. That night Scott Bloom and Dawn heard a terrible moaning sound. Dawn.
It was like something from the grave. It really was.
Jack woke just as the moaning was subsiding. He got his flashlight and walked around the camper, but found nothing. When he returned to the camper, he found that his family had once more been wound tight to the point of breaking. At first light, Jack went to the manager of the campground and told the man that the family was headed back home.
Day early? The man said.
Jack frowned. That's been happening again. Earlier, Jack had confided in the man what had been taking place the past few years, including the supernatural incidents that had happened here, at the campground. Jack had been afraid that the man would tell him that the Smurl family was not welcome here. Instead, the man had been very sympathetic, as he was now.
Any way I can help?
Jack smiled grimly.
I sure wish there was.
In the drizzle, the sky slate gray as in wintertime, the surrounding hills lost in a soft, silver mist, the Smurl family packed up its belongings. It had not been the trip they had hoped for. Jack fought against an anger that threatened to overwhelm him. He knew he needed to remain in control for the sake of his loved ones. On the way back home, Karen slept with her head in Janet's lap. When she woke up, Karen began crying very softly. Nobody had to ask why. Lorraine Warren.
Ed and I had been working on another case in upstate New York when the Smurls returned home and phoned us about their experiences at the campground. And the disturbances had only increased when they'd gotten home. The house filled with the smell of fecal matter when they first opened the door, and that was followed a few days later by an incident we had never encountered in all our years as psychic investigators. We got Janet to describe it in detail.
Do you remember anything special about that morning?
I was very, very tired. The trip to the campground had worn me out. This was a few days after our return, and I was still in bed at 10 in the morning, which was very unlike me. But for some reason, probably a combination of exhaustion and depression, I really couldn't drag myself out of bed. And that's when it happened.
Can you describe it?
I can try.
It was a hand.
Yes. A human hand.
And it came from where?
Right up through the mattress.
A human hand, right up through the mattress?
While I was lying there.
Did it try to choke you?
No. It just grabbed me by the back of the neck and held me.
It felt like a human hand?
Yes. It was very powerful. You could feel its muscles, hot and sort of clammy, I guess, at the same time.
Did you try to get away?
I tried, but it didn't do any good.
You couldn't move?
Right.
What did you do?
It was very odd. I just sort of resigned myself. Always before I'd fought back, but after I realized I couldn't move, I thought, what's the use? Actually, I started talking to it.
To the hand?
Yes. And to the demon that controlled the hand.
What did you say?
I said, I don't care what you do to me. If you want to kill me, go ahead. I'm not going to fight back or anything. I'm starting to lose my will and maybe even my sanity, so why don't you just go ahead and get it over with? Take me right here and right now, but leave the rest of my family alone.
Then what happened?
The hand disappeared.
Just like that?
Just like that.
Did the haunting subside for a while then?
No. And that was when I realized that the demon took a great deal of pleasure in tormenting us. It enjoyed sapping our energy. In that sense, it was like a vampire needing blood. Only this demon needed our body heat and our spiritual energy, and it enjoyed keeping us right on the edge, all the time, right on the edge.
So the haunting continued.
Just that night, the banging in the walls started again, and then the next day I saw Simon sort of mysteriously drawn to our upstairs closet where the demon liked to dwell. I barely got Simon back before he went inside. And then in the bedroom later on, I heard these whispers that started to become moans, and I was...
You were what?
I was afraid I was losing my mind.
The whispers, you mean?
Everything. You really start to doubt your own sanity. Here, everything around you looks very familiar. Cars and appliances and groceries. Only there's something else, too. Some other dimension that other people don't have to endure. And when you're exposed to that dimension long enough, well, obviously it starts to take its toll on you and on everybody around you. Jack got home that afternoon and I was really sobbing. I just couldn't handle it anymore. He had to let me sit in his lap, as if I was a little girl. I really just couldn't deal with it. There was a part of me that wished the demon had taken me up on my offer. You know, that they could take my life if it would just leave my family alone. That way there would have been peace for everybody. That way the demon would have finally left us alone. I mean, we knew after staying at the campground for a week that there was going to be no peace for us. No matter where we went, it was going to follow us. No matter where we went.
It even appeared to you and your mother, didn't it?
Yes.
Would you tell us about that? Gathers herself.
Around 10 o'clock the following evening, my own mother, Gloria, came to visit. We sat in the kitchen and we saw this white, almost blinding form appear on the other side of the screen door. It had the intensity of a fireworks display with a very, very white center. Gradually, we saw that the longer we stared at it, the more it resembled the black form that had appeared so many times before, except this one was a white-gold color. My mother held my hand the whole time. The form stood there, and when it vanished, she started crying. I'd rarely seen her this upset. Ordinarily, she's a composed person, but then I realized how accustomed I was getting to supernatural phenomena, and I had to take into account that for other people such events were overwhelming. I took my mother in my arms and held her for a very long time, and then afterward we sat back down at the table and had a very intimate conversation. The intense fear that we had shared had brought us even closer. I told her how much I loved her and cared about her, and she told me the same things.
At the same time, the demon was working on John Smurl, too, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. The next morning, John was getting ready to go to work when he heard this voice say, "Don't I look sexy in bed?" Now, you'd expect that the person speaking would be Mary, but, of course, it wasn't. Mary was asleep, and John knew it. He told me he stood there for maybe 2 minutes, almost afraid to turn around. Afraid of what he would see. But when he did turn around, there was nothing. Just empty space. The demon had begun imitating family voices.
The demon also created a terrible new way to terrorize you, too, didn't it?
Yes. Striking in two places at once. While Kim was in the bathroom with Simon, it started whispering to Simon, and Kim heard it, and at the exact same time, on the other side of the duplex, it appeared to Mary in the form of a very grotesque dog that scooted under her couch.
It showed itself to Shannon, too.
Shannon was asleep during a very bad electric storm, and when she woke up, she saw a white form, much like the one my mother and I had seen, with very big black eyes, as she described them to us.